The third stop on the roadmap of failure is the most frequent, the most surprising, and assumes a wide variety of forms. It turns out that societies often fail even to attempt to solve a problem once it has been perceived. Many of the reasons for such failure fall under the heading of what social scientists term rational behavior, arising from clashes of interest between people. That is, some people may reason correctly that they can advance their own interests by behavior harmful to other people. Scientists term such behavior rational, precisely because it employs correct reasoning, even though it may be morally reprehensible. The perpetrators know that they will often get away with their bad behavior, especially if there's no law against it or if the law isn't effectively enforced. They feel safe, because the perpetrators are typically few in number and highly motivated by the prospect of reaping big, certain, and immediate profits, while the losses are spread over large numbers of individuals. That gives the losers little motivation to go to the hassle of fighting back, because each loser loses only a little and would receive only small, uncertain, distant profits from successfully undoing the minority's grab. Examples include so-called perverse subsidies, the large sums of money that governments pay to support industries that might be uneconomic without the subsidies, such as sugar growing in the U.S. The relatively few growers lobby tenaciously for the subsidies that represent much of their income, while the losers, all the taxpayers, are less vocal because the subsidy is funded by just a small amount of money conceded in each citizen's tax bill. Measures benefiting a small minority at the expense of a large majority are especially likely to arise in certain types of democracies that bestow swing power on some small groups, for example, senators from small states in the U.S. Senate. A frequent type of rational bad behavior is good for me, bad for you, and for everybody else. An example is that until 1971, mining companies in Montana, on closing down a mine, just left it with its copper, arsenic, and acid leaking out into rivers because the state had no law requiring companies to clean up after mine closure. In 1971, the state of Montana did pass such a law, but companies discovered that they could extract the valuable ore and then just declare bankruptcy before going to the expense of cleaning up. The result has been about $500 million of cleanup costs to be borne by the citizens of Montana and the U.S. One particular form of clashes of interest has become well known under the name Tragedy of the Commons. Consider a situation in which many consumers are harvesting a communally owned resource, such as fishermen catching fish in an area of ocean, or herders grazing their sheep on a communal pasture. If everybody overharvests the resource, it will become depleted and thus decline or even disappear, and all of the consumers will suffer. It would therefore be in the common interests of all consumers to exercise restraint and not overharvest. But as long as there is no effective regulation, then each consumer would be correct to reason, if I don't catch that fish or let my sheep graze that grass, some other fisherman or herder will anyway, so it makes no sense for me to refrain. The correct rational behavior is then to harvest before the next consumer can, even though the eventual result may be the destruction of the commons. One obvious solution is for the government or some other outside force to step in. However, that is impractical in some situations, such as the open ocean, and involves excessive administrative and policing costs in other situations. A second solution is to privatize the resource, dividing it into individually owned tracts that each owner will be motivated to manage prudently in his or her own interests. Again, though, some resources, such as migratory animals and fish, are impossible to subdivide, and the individual owners may find it hard to exclude intruders. The remaining solution to the tragedy of the commons is for the consumers to recognize their common interests and to design, obey, and enforce prudent harvesting quotas themselves. That is likely to happen only if a whole series of conditions is met. The consumers form a homogeneous group. They have learned to trust and communicate with each other. They expect to share a common future and to pass on the resource to their heirs. They are capable of and permitted to organize and police themselves. And the boundaries of the resource and of its pool of consumers are well defined. Examples of homogeneous groups prudently managing resources that they expect to pass to their children are the Tikopia Islanders and New Guinea Highlanders. Those small groups, along with the Icelanders and the Tokugawa Japanese, were further motivated to reach agreement by their effective isolation. It was obvious to the whole group that they would have to survive just on their resources for the foreseeable future. Clashes of interest involving rational behavior are also prone to arise when the principal consumer has no long-term stake in preserving the resource, but society as a whole does. For example, much commercial harvesting of tropical rainforests today is carried out by international logging companies, which typically take out short-term leases on land in one country, cut down the rainforest on all their leased land, and then move on to the next country. In that way, loggers destroyed most of the lowland forests of the Malay Peninsula, then of Borneo, then of the Solomon Islands and Sumatra, now of the Philippines, and coming up soon of New Guinea, the Amazon, and the Congo Basin. What is good for the loggers is bad for the local people, who lose their source of forest products and suffer consequences of soil erosion and stream sedimentation. It's also bad for the host country as a whole, which loses some of its biodiversity and its foundation for sustainable forestry. A further conflict of interest involving rational behavior arises when the interests of the decision-making elite in power clash with the interests of the rest of society. Especially if the elite can insulate themselves from the consequences of their actions, they are likely to do things that profit themselves, regardless of whether those actions hurt everybody else. Throughout recorded history, actions or inactions by self-absorbed kings, chiefs, and politicians have been a regular cause of societal collapses, including those of the Maya kings, Greenland Norse chiefs, and modern Rwandan politicians discussed in this book. As a result of lust for power, Easter Island chiefs and Maya kings acted so as to accelerate deforestation rather than to prevent it. Their status depended on their putting up bigger statues and monuments than their rivals. Conversely, failures to solve perceived problems because of conflicts of interest between the elite and the masses are much less likely in societies where the elite cannot insulate themselves from the consequences of their actions. New Guinea Highlands big men live in the same type of huts as everyone else, scrounge for firewood and timber in the same places as everyone else, and were thereby highly motivated to solve their society's need for sustainable forestry. All of these examples illustrate situations in which a society fails to try to solve perceived problems because the maintenance of the problem is good for some people. Other failures involve what social scientists consider irrational behavior, that is, behavior that is harmful for everybody. Such irrational behavior often arises when each of us individually is torn by clashes of values. We may ignore a bad status quo because it is favored by some deeply held value to which we cling. Psychologists use the term sunk cost effect for a related trait. We feel reluctant to abandon a policy or sell a stock in which we have already invested heavily. Religious values tend to be especially deeply held and hence frequent causes of disastrous behavior. For example, much of the deforestation of Easter Island had a religious motivation, to obtain logs to transport and erect the giant stone statues that were the object of veneration. The modern world provides us with abundant secular examples of values to which we cling. Australians brought from Britain a tradition of raising sheep for wool and an identification with Britain, but are now beginning to appreciate that those values also have downsides. A reason why Montanans have been so reluctant to solve their problems caused by mining, logging, and ranching is that those three industries became bound up with Montana's pioneer spirit and identity. Communist China's determination not to repeat the errors of capitalism led it to scorn environmental concerns as just one more capitalist era, and thereby to saddle China with enormous environmental problems. Rwandan's ideal of large families was appropriate in traditional times of high childhood mortality, but has led to a disastrous population explosion today. It appears to me that much of the rigid opposition to environmental concerns in the first world nowadays involves values acquired early in life and never again re-examined. It is painfully difficult to decide whether to abandon some of one's core values when they seem to be becoming incompatible with survival. All such decisions involve gambles, because one often can't be certain that clinging to core values will be fatal, or that abandoning them will ensure survival. Among five small Eastern European countries faced with the overwhelming might of Russian armies, the Estonians, Latvians, and Lithuanians surrendered in 1939 without a fight. The Finns fought in 1939 to 1940 and preserved their independence, and Hungarians fought in 1956 and lost their independence. Who among us is to say which country was wiser, and who could have predicted in advance that only the Finns would win their gamble? Perhaps a crux of success or failure as a society is to know which core values to hold on to and which ones to discard and replace with new values when times change. In the last 60 years, the world's most powerful countries have given up long-held, cherished values previously central to their national image while holding on to other values. Britain and France abandoned their centuries-old role as independently acting world powers. Japan abandoned its military tradition and armed forces, and Russia abandoned its long experiment with communism. The United States has retreated substantially from its former values of legalized racial discrimination, legalized homophobia, a subordinate role of women, and sexual repression. Societies and individuals that succeed may be those that have the courage to take those difficult decisions and that have the luck to win their gambles. Irrational failures to try to solve perceived problems also arise from clashes between short-term and long-term motives of the same individual. Billions of people in the world today are desperately poor and think only of food for the next day. Poor fishermen in tropical reef areas use dynamite and cyanide to kill coral reef fish in order to feed their children today, in the full knowledge that they are thereby destroying their future livelihood. Governments, too, regularly operate on a short-term focus. They feel overwhelmed by imminent disasters and pay attention only to problems that are on the verge of explosion. Finally, even after a society has anticipated, perceived, or tried to solve a problem, it may still fail for obvious possible reasons. The problem may be beyond our present capacities to solve. A solution may exist but be prohibitively expensive, or our efforts may be too little and too late. Some attempted solutions backfire and make the problem worse. Many past societies lack the detailed ecological knowledge that now permits us to cope better with the problems that they faced. Others of those problems continue to resist solution today. Among the most recalcitrant problems today are those posed by introduced pest species, which often prove impossible to eradicate or control once they have become established. For example, the state of Montana continues to spend over $100 million per year on combating leafy spurge and other introduced weed species. That's not because Montanans don't try to eradicate them, but simply because the weeds are impossible to eradicate at present. The problem of catastrophic forest fires in dry parts of the U.S. intermontane West could probably be brought under control by management techniques to reduce the fuel load. Unfortunately, carrying out that solution on a large scale is considered prohibitively expensive. Thus, human societies and smaller groups may make disastrous decisions for a whole sequence of reasons, but it's obvious that societies don't regularly fail to solve their problems. If that were true, all of us would now be dead or else living again under the Stone Age conditions of 13,000 years ago. Why, then, do some societies succeed and others fail? For instance, why did the Inca Empire succeed in reafforesting its dry, cool environment, while the Easter Islanders and Greenland Norse didn't? The answer partly depends on idiosyncrasies of particular individuals and will defy prediction. But I still hope that better understanding of the potential causes of failure may help planners to become aware of those causes and to avoid them. All modern societies depend on extracting natural resources, both non-renewable resources like oil and metals, and renewable ones like wood and fish. The economies of dozens of countries depend heavily on extractive industries. Our societies are committed to extracting those resources. The only questions involve where and what amounts and by what means we choose to do so. Because a resource extraction project usually requires large capital inputs up front, most of the extraction is done by big businesses. Familiar controversies exist between environmentalists and big businesses, which tend to view each other as enemies. The interest of big businesses, environmentalists, and society as a whole coincide more often than you might guess. In other cases, however, there really is a conflict of interest. What makes money for a business may be harmful to society as a whole. This section will use examples from four different extractive industries to explore some of the reasons why companies perceive it as being in their interests to adopt different policies, either harming or sparing the environment. My experience of the oil industry in the New Guinea region has involved two oil fields at opposite ends of the spectrum of harmful versus beneficial environmental impacts. I found these experiences instructive because I had previously assumed that oil industry impacts were overwhelmingly harmful. My first experience of an oil field was on Salawati Island off the coast of Indonesian New Guinea. The purpose of my visit was part of a survey of birds. It merely happened that much of Salawati had been leased to the Indonesian National Oil Company, Pertamina. I visited in 1986 as a guest of Pertamina, whose vice president and public relations officer kindly provided me with a vehicle to drive along company roads. In view of that kindness, I am sorry to report on the conditions that I encountered. From a long distance, the field's location could be recognized by a flame shooting out of a high tower, where natural gas obtained as a byproduct of oil extraction was being burned off, there being nothing else to do with it. Facilities to liquefy and transport it for sale were lacking. To construct access roads through Salawati's forests, swaths 100 yards wide had been cleared, much too wide for many rainforest mammals, birds, frogs, and reptiles to cross. There were numerous oil spills on the ground. I encountered only three species of large fruit pigeons, of which 14 have been recorded elsewhere on Salawati. A Pertamina employee described to me the location of two pigeon breeding colonies, where he said that he hunted them with his shotgun. I assumed that their numbers within the field had been depleted by hunting. My second experience was of the Kutubu oil field that a subsidiary of the large international oil company Chevron Corporation operated in the Kikori River watershed of Papua New Guinea. The environment in the Kikori River watershed is sensitive and difficult to work in because of frequent landslides, much limestone karst terrain, and having one of the highest recorded rainfalls in the world, 430 inches per year and up to 14 inches per day. In 1993, Chevron engaged World Wildlife Fund to prepare a large-scale integrated conservation and development project for the whole watershed. Chevron's expectation was that WWF would be effective at minimizing environmental damage, lobbying the Papua New Guinea government for environmental protection, serving as a credible partner in the eyes of environmental activist groups, benefiting local communities economically, and attracting World Bank funding for local community projects. From 1998 to 2003, I made four visits of 1 month each to the oil fields and watershed as a consultant to WWF. I was allowed freedom to travel throughout the area in a WWF vehicle and to interview Chevron employees privately. As my flight from Papua New Guinea's capital of Port Moresby droned on towards the field's main airstrip at Moro, I looked out the window for some signs of the oil field infrastructure. I became increasingly puzzled, still to be seeing only an uninterrupted expanse of rainforest. Finally, I spotted a road, but it was only a thin, cleared line about 10 yards broad through the rainforest, in many places overhung with trees growing on either side. On the following day, when I began walking along that pencil line of a road during my surveys, I found birds routinely flying across it, and mammals, lizards, snakes, and frogs hopping, running, or crawling across it. It turned out that the road had been designed to be just broad enough for two vehicles to pass safely in opposite directions. I had walked out on the road before dawn to birdwatch and returned a few hours later. The camp safety representative summoned me to his office and told me that I had already been reported for two violations of Chevron regulations, which I was not to repeat. First, I had been noticed stepping several feet out into the roadway to observe a bird. That posed the hazard that a vehicle might hit me, or that in swerving to avoid hitting me, it might crash into an oil pipeline at the side of the road and cause an oil spill. From now on, I should please stay off the road while birdwatching. Second, I had been seen birdwatching while not wearing a protective helmet, but this whole area was a hard hat area. At this point, the officer gave me a hard hat, which I should henceforth please wear for my own safety. That was an introduction to Chevron's extreme concern. I have never observed an oil spill on any of my four visits, but I do read the reports posted each month on Chevron bulletin boards about incidents and near incidents. Out of interest, I recorded the full list of 14 incidents from March 2003. The most serious were that a truck backed into a stop sign. Another truck was reported with its emergency brake improperly set. A package of chemicals lacked the correct paperwork, and gas was found leaking from a compressor needle valve. My remaining surprise came in the course of birdwatching. New Guinea has many bird and mammal species whose presence and abundance are sensitive indicators of human disturbance. When I began birdwatching in the Kutubu area, I anticipated that my main goal would be to determine how much less numerous these species were inside the area of Chevron's oil fields, facilities, and pipeline than outside it. Instead, I discovered to my astonishment that these species are much more numerous inside the Chevron area than anywhere else that I have visited on the island of New Guinea, except for a few remote uninhabited areas. That's because there is an absolute prohibition against Chevron employees and contractors hunting any animal or fishing by any means in the project area, and because the forest is intact. In effect, the Kutubu oil field functions as by far the largest and most rigorously controlled national park in Papua New Guinea. For months, I was greatly puzzled by these conditions in the Kutubu oil field. After all, Chevron is a for-profit oil company owned by its shareholders. If Chevron were to spend money on environmental policies that ultimately decreased its profits from its oil operations, its shareholders would and should sue it. The company evidently decided that those policies would ultimately help it make more money from its oil operations. How do they help? Chevron Company publications refer to concern for the environment itself as a motivating factor. That is undoubtedly true. However, I have come to realize that many other factors as well have contributed to these environmental policies. One is the importance of avoiding very expensive environmental disasters. Chevron realized that by spending each year an extra few million dollars on a project, or even a few tens of millions of dollars, they would save money in the long run by minimizing the risk of losing billions of dollars in such an accident, or of having an entire project closed down and losing its whole investment. A related factor is public expectations. Oil spills tend to be highly visible. The impact of the spill is usually obvious. For instance, in the form of oil-coated dead birds whose pictures saturate television screens and newspapers. Hence, the public can be expected to howl at the kind of big environmental mistake most likely for an oil company. The trend throughout the world, with obvious exceptions, is for governments, as the years pass, to demand more rather than less rigorous environmental precautions. Oil companies have learned that it is far cheaper to build a clean facility incorporating environmental precautions at the outset than to retrofit that facility later when government standards become tightened. Still, a further advantage to Chevron's environmentally clean practices is that the reputation that it has thereby gained sometimes gives it a competitive advantage in obtaining contracts. For example, recently the government of Norway solicited bids for development of an oil-gas field in the North Sea. Chevron succeeded in winning the contract, probably in part because of its good environmental reputation. The Norwegian contract might have been the biggest single financial benefit to the company from its rigid environmental safeguards in the Kutubu oil fields. A company's audience includes not only the public, governments, and local landowners, but also its employees. An oil field poses complicated technological, construction, and management problems, and a large fraction of oil company employees have higher education and advanced degrees. They tend to be environmentally aware. All those employees see for themselves the state of the environment in the oil fields, and they see the company's commitment to clean environmental policies. Many Chevron employees told me that that issue of employee morale and environmental views was both a benefit of their company's visibly clean environmental policies and also a driving force behind the adoption of those policies in the first place. Finally, new technology has made it easier for oil companies to operate more cleanly now than in the past. For instance, several horizontal or diagonal wells can now be drilled from a single surface location. The rock debris that is ground up as a well is drilled can now be pumped into an isolated underground formation containing no producible oil, instead of dumping the rocks into a pit or into the ocean. Natural gas obtained as a byproduct of oil extraction is now either re-injected into an underground reservoir or shipped out by pipeline or else liquefied for storage and transport by ship and then sold, instead of burning it off. These, then, are reasons why Chevron and the handful of other big international oil companies have been taking environmental issues seriously What it all adds up to is that clean environmental practices help them make money and gain long-term access to new oil and gas fields. I'm not claiming that the oil industry is now uniformly clean, responsible, and admirable in its behavior. Among the most widely publicized, persisting, and serious problems are recent large spills at sea from wrecks of poorly maintained and poorly operated single-hulled tankers. Other major problems include legacies of old, environmentally dirty facilities and operations under the auspices of corrupt and abusive governments, such as those of Nigeria and Indonesia. Let's now turn from the oil and gas industry to the hard rock mining industry. That term refers to mines that excavate ores as opposed to coal. The industry is currently the leading toxic polluter in the U.S., responsible for nearly half of reported industrial pollution. Of western U.S. rivers, nearly half have sections of their headwaters polluted by mining. In most of the U.S., the hard rock mining industry is now declining towards extinction, largely because of its own misdeeds. The environmental problems caused by hard rock mining are of several types. One involves disturbance of land surface by digging it up. This problem especially affects surface mines and open pit mines, where the ore lies near the surface and is reached by scraping away the earth over it. Further environmental problems involve water pollution by metals themselves, processing chemicals, acid drainage, and sediment. In addition to those types of pollution, the mere consumption of water by many mines is high enough to be significant. The remaining environmental problem concerns where to dump all the dirt and wastes dug up in the course of mining, consisting of four components: the overburden, dirt scraped away to get down to the ore, waste rock found to contain too little mineral to be of economic value, tailings, the ground-up residue of ore after its minerals have been extracted, and the residues of heap leach pads after mineral extraction. Depending on the laws in the particular country where the mine is located, the methods of disposing of tailings involve either dumping them into a river or ocean, piling them up on land, or, most often, piling them up behind a dam. Unfortunately, tailings dams fail in a surprisingly high percentage of cases. On the average around the world each year, there is one big accident involving a tailings dam. The largest such accident in the U.S. was West Virginia's Buffalo Creek disaster of 1972, which killed 125 people. The prevalent policy of mining companies is to clean up and restore the mined area only after the mine is shut down, rather than follow the coal mining industry's practice of reclaiming the area as mining proceeds. The hard rock mining industry opposes that strategy. Companies assume that what is called walkaway restoration will be adequate. That is, that cleanup and restoration will incur minimal cost, will go on for only 2 to 12 years after mine closure, whereupon the company can walk away from the site with no further obligations, and will involve nothing more than resloping of disturbed areas to prevent erosion, applying a growth medium like salvaged topsoil to stimulate revegetation, and treating water flowing out of the mine site for a few years. In reality, this inexpensive walkaway strategy has never sufficed for any major modern mine, and regularly leaves water quality standards violated. The actual direct and indirect costs of cleanup and restoration have typically proved to be 1.5 to 2 times mining industry walkaway estimates for mines without acid drainage, and 10 times those estimates for mines with acid drainage. Hard rock mining companies facing cleanup costs frequently avoid those costs by declaring bankruptcy and transferring their assets to other corporations controlled by the same individuals. As a result, American states and the federal government eventually began to require hard rock mining companies to guarantee that enough money would be available for cleanup and restoration, in case the mining company itself refused or proved financially unable to pay for the cleanup. Unfortunately, those assurance costs are typically based on a cleanup cost estimate made by the mining company itself. In the many cases when mining companies have not cleaned up and the government has been forced to fall back on that assurance, the actual cleanup costs have proved to be up to 100 times the mining company estimate. The assurance is provided in one of three forms: cash equivalents or a letter of credit, the safest form, a bond that the mining company obtains from an insurance company in return for an annual premium, and a self-guarantee, meaning that the mining company pledges in good faith that it will clean up and that its assets stand behind its pledge. However, frequent breaking of such pledges has shown self-guarantees to be meaningless, and they are now no longer accepted for mines on federal land. But they still account for most assurance in Arizona and Nevada, the American states most friendly to the mining industry. U.S. taxpayers currently face a liability of up to $12 billion to clean up and restore hard rock mines. Why is our liability so large when governments have supposedly been requiring financial assurance of cleanup costs? Parts of the difficulty are the just-mentioned ones of costs being underestimated by the mining companies, and the two states with the biggest taxpayer liabilities, Arizona and Nevada, accepting company self-guarantees. Even when an insurance company bond exists, taxpayers faced further costs, for reasons that will be familiar to any of us who have tried to collect from our insurance company for a large loss in a home fire. The insurance company regularly reduces the amount of the bond payoff by what are euphemistically termed negotiations. That is, if you don't like our reduced offer, you may go to the expense of hiring lawyers and waiting 5 years for the courts to resolve the case. Then the insurance company pays out the bond at a negotiated amount only over the years as cleanup and restoration are carried out. But the bond contains no clause for inevitable cost escalations with time. Not surprisingly, there has been a backlash of anti-mining public sentiment in Montana and some other states. The future of hard rock mining in the U.S. is bleak. Since 1995, public opposition in the U.S. has been increasingly successful in blocking mine proposals, and the mining industry can no longer count on lobbyists and friendly legislators to do its bidding. The hard rock mining industry is the prime example of a business whose short-term favoring of its own interests over those of the public proved in the long term self-defeating and have been driving the industry into extinction. This sad outcome is initially surprising. How could the hard rock mining industry have adopted such self-defeating behavior, especially when the oil industry and the coal mining industry, facing apparently similar problems, have not driven themselves towards extinction? The answer had to do with the three sets of factors: economics, mining industry attitudes, and society's attitude. Economic factors make environmental cleanup costs less bearable to the hard rock mining industry than to the oil industry. The industry as a whole operates at such low profit margins that its average rate of return over the last 25 years hasn't even met the cost of its capital. That is, if a mining company CEO with $1,000 to spare had invested it in 1979, then by the year 2000, the investment would have grown to only $2,220 if invested in steel industry stock, to only $1,530 if invested in metal stocks other than iron and steel, but to $9,320 if invested in an average mutual fund. Even those mediocre profits are unpredictable. Half of all mines that are developed prove unprofitable. The average profits of the whole mining industry are also unpredictable, because metals prices are notoriously volatile and fluctuate to a much greater degree than do oil and coal prices. Hard rock mines create far more wastes, requiring much more expensive cleanup costs than do oil wells. If it weren't for the access roads and the occasional oil spill, oil and gas extraction would have little environmental impact. In contrast, the ratio of waste dirt to metal is typically 400 for a copper mine and 5 million for a gold mine. That's a huge amount of dirt to clean up. Pollution problems are more insidious and much more long-lasting for the mining industry than for the oil industry. Oil spills can generally be cleaned up within a few years or less, and oil degrades naturally. While mine pollution problems also occasionally appear as a quick visible pulse that suddenly kills lots of fish or birds, more often they take the form of a chronic leak of toxic metals and acid that don't degrade naturally, continue to leak for centuries, and leave slowly weakened people rather than a sudden pile of carcasses. Oil is a bulk material that we see. We consider it essential. We don't balk too much at paying higher prices. Hence, the oil industry may have been able to pass on their costs of environmental cleanup to consumers. But metals, other than iron, in the form of steel, are mostly used for invisible little parts inside our cars, phones, and other equipment. If increased environmental costs of copper mining tend to increase the cost of your car, you don't say to yourself, sure, I'm willing to pay another dollar per ounce for copper, just as long as I can still buy a car this year. Instead, you shop around for a better deal on a car. The copper middlemen and car manufacturers know how you feel, and they pressure the mining companies into keeping their prices down. That makes it hard for a mining company to pass on its cleanup costs. Both the oil industry and the hard rock mining industry face so-called legacy problems, which mean the burden of costs from a century of environmentally damaging practices before the recent growth of environmental awareness. To pay those costs, as of the year 2001, the total capitalization of the entire mining industry was only $250 billion. But the leading individual companies and other industries, Walmart stores, Microsoft, Pfizer, ExxonMobil, and others, had capitalizations of $250 billion each. Hence, those legacy problems are relatively a much heavier burden on the hard rock mining industry than on the oil industry. Thus, there are many economic reasons why it is more burdensome for mining companies than for oil companies to pay cleanup costs. In the short run, it's cheaper for a mining company just to pay lobbyists to press for weak regulatory laws. That strategy has worked, until recently. Those economic disincentives are exacerbated by the attitudes and corporate culture that have become traditional within the hard rock mining industry. In the history of the U.S., the government promoted mining as a tool to encourage settlement of the West. Hence, the mining industry evolved in the U.S. with an inflated sense of entitlement. Mine executives respond to environmental criticism with homilies on how civilization would be impossible without mining. Civilization as we know it would also be impossible without oil, farm food, or wood. But oil executives, farmers, and loggers, nevertheless, don't cling to that quasi-religious fundamentalism of mine executives. God put those metals there for the benefit of mankind, to be mined. To claims of toxic problems at mines, the mining industry routinely responds with denial. No one in the oil industry today would deny that spilled oil is harmful. But mine executives do deny the harm of spilled metals and acid. The third factor underlying mining industry environmental practices, besides economics and corporate attitudes, is the attitudes of our government and society, which permit the industry to continue with its own attitudes. The basic federal law governing mining in the U.S. is still the General Mining Act passed in 1872. It provides massive subsidies to mining companies, such as $1 billion per year of royalty-free minerals from publicly owned lands, unlimited use of public lands for dumping mine waste in some cases, and other subsidies costing taxpayers $250 million per year. The detail rules adopted by the federal government in 1980, termed the 3809 rules, did not require mining companies to provide financial assurance of cleanup costs and did not adequately define reclamation and closure. In the year 2000, the outgoing Clinton administration proposed mining regulations that achieved both of those goals, while also eliminating corporate self-guarantees of financial assurance. But in October 2001, a proposal by the incoming Bush administration eliminated almost all of those proposals except for continuing to require financial assurance, a requirement that would in any case be meaningless without a definition of the reclamation and cleanup costs to be covered by financial assurance. It is rare that our society has effectively held the mining industry responsible for damages. Laws, regulatory policies, and the political will to chase mining scofflaws have been absent. For example, the state of New Mexico estimated reclamation costs for the Chino copper mine of Phelps Dodge Corp. mine of $180 million, but then decreased that estimate to $391 million under political pressure from Phelps Dodge. When our American public and governments demand so little of the mining industry, why should we be surprised that the industry itself volunteers little? Coal mining is superficially even more similar to hard rock mining than is the oil industry, in that its operations inevitably create heavy environmental impacts. Coal mines tend to make even bigger messes than do hard rock mines because the quantity of coal extracted per year is relatively enormous. Thus, coal mines usually disturb more area. And in some cases, they strip the soil down to bedrock and dump mountaintops into rivers. On the other hand, coal occurs in pure seams up to 10 feet thick, stretching for miles, so that the ratio of dumped waste to product extracted is only about 1 for a coal mine, far less than 400 for a copper mine and 5 million for a gold mine. The lethal Buffalo Creek disaster at a U.S. coal mine in 1972 served as a wake-up call for the coal industry, much as the Exxon Valdez disaster did for the oil industry. Stimulated by Buffalo Creek, the U.S. federal government instituted tighter regulation and required stricter operating plans and financial assurance for coal mining than for hard rock mining. The initial response of the coal industry to those government initiatives was to prophesy disaster for the industry. But 20 years later, that has been forgotten, and the coal industry has learned to live with the new regulations. One reason is that many coal mines are in flatland, not highly valued for other reasons, so that restoration is economically feasible. Unlike the hard rock mining industry, the coal industry now often restores mined areas within a year or two of ceasing operations. Another reason may be that coal, unlike gold, is perceived as a necessity for our society, so the coal industry may have been able to pass on its increased environmental costs to consumers. Still another factor behind the response of the coal industry is that it typically has short, transparent supply chains. That makes it easy for the public to figure out whether any particular consumer of coal is obtaining it from a cleanly or dirtily operated coal mining company. Oil has a supply chain that is even shorter. Big oil companies like Chevron, Texaco, ExxonMobil, and BP sell their fuel to consumers at their own gas stations, thereby permitting consumers enraged by the Exxon Valdez disaster to boycott Exxon gas stations. But gold passes from mine to the consumer via a long supply chain that includes refiners, warehouses, jewelry manufacturers in India, and European wholesalers before arriving at a retail jewelry store. Take a look at your wedding ring. You don't have the faintest idea where the gold came from, whether it was mined last year or stockpiled for the last 20 years, what company mined it, and what their environmental practices were. For copper, the situation is even more obscure. That long supply chain prevents copper and gold mining companies from counting on consumer willingness to pay for cleaner mines. In 1998, top executives of some of the world's largest international mining companies became concerned that their industry around the world was losing its social license to operate, as the expression goes. They formed an initiative termed the Mining Minerals and Sustainable Development Project, launched a series of studies on sustainable mining, enlisted a well-known environmentalist as director of the initiative, and attempted, without success, to involve the broader environmental community, which refused because of its historical disgust with mining companies. In the year 2002, the study arrived at a series of recommendations, but then most of the mining companies involved unfortunately declined to implement the recommendations. The exception is the British mining giant Rio Tinto, which decided to move ahead on some of the recommendations on its own, under pressure from its strongly supportive CEO and from British stockholders. Its borax mine in California's Death Valley is now perhaps the most cleanly operated mine in the U.S. One payoff that Rio Tinto has already reaped is that when Tiffany & Company decided to stress environmental considerations in selecting a mining company to which to award a contract as gold supplier, Tiffany chose Rio Tinto because of the latter's increasingly clean reputation. The remaining instructive example involves U.S.-based DuPont Company, the world's leading buyer of titanium metal and titanium compounds used in paints, jet engines, high-speed planes and space vehicles, and other purposes. Much titanium is extracted from Australian beach sands rich in rutile, a mineral that consists of almost pure titanium dioxide. DuPont buys rutile from Australian mining companies. However, DuPont puts its name on all its products, including its titanium-based house paints, and it does not want all its products to get a bad reputation just because its titanium suppliers arouse consumer wrath through dirty practices. Hence, DuPont, in collaboration with public interest groups, has worked out buyers' agreements and suppliers' codes of responsibility that it enforces on all of its Australian titanium suppliers. These two examples involving Tiffany and DuPont illustrate an important point. Consumers have leverage over Tiffany, DuPont, and other retailers that buy metals and that have the technical ability to distinguish clean from dirty mines. At least in the short run, environmental safeguards, cleanup, and restoration incur costs for mining companies adopting them, regardless of whether government regulations or public attitudes ensure that the safeguards save the company's money in the long run. Who should pay for those costs? The reality is that the mining industry is, on the average, so unprofitable that consumers could not point to excessive company profits from which costs should be met. Even the cleanest methods for mining coal and copper create messes. If we want coal and copper, we have to recognize the environmental costs of extracting them as a legitimate necessary cost of mining. The environmental costs should be factored into metals prices and passed on to consumers, just as oil and coal companies already do. Only the long and opaque supply chain from mineral mines to the public and the historically bad behavior of most mining companies have obscured this simple conclusion to date. The remaining two resource extraction industries that I shall discuss are the logging industry and the fishing industry. They differ from the oil industry, the hard rock mining industry, and the coal industry in two basic ways. First, trees and fish are renewable resources that reproduce themselves. Hence, if you harvest them at a rate no higher than the rate at which they reproduce, your harvest can be sustained indefinitely. Second, in the logging and fishing industries, the things that you are removing, the trees and the fish, are valuable parts of the environment. Hence, any logging or fishing, almost by definition, may cause environmental damage. For humans, forests represent much value that becomes jeopardized by cutting them down. Most obviously, they are our principal source of timber products. For third world people, who constitute a substantial fraction of the world's population, they are also the principal source of non-timber products, such as natural rope and roofing materials, birds and mammals hunted for food, fruit and nuts and other edible plant parts, and plant-derived medicines. Trees function as the world's major air filter, removing carbon monoxide and other air pollutants. Water transpiration from trees returns water to the atmosphere, so that deforestation tends to cause diminished rainfall and increased desertification. Trees retain water in the soil and keep it moist. They protect the land's surface against landslides, erosion, and sediment runoff into streams. Some forests, notably some tropical rainforests, hold the major portion of an ecosystem's nutrients, so that logging and carting the logs away tends to leave the cleared land infertile. Finally, forests provide the habitat for most other living things on the land. For instance, tropical forests cover 6% of the world's land surface, but hold between 50 and 80% of the world's terrestrial species of plants and animals. Given all these values of forests, loggers have developed many ways of minimizing the potentially negative environmental impacts of logging. These ways include removing individual trees selectively, rather than clear-cutting, logging at a sustainable rate, cutting small patches of forest so that the cut area remains surrounded by trees producing seeds to start regrowth of the logged area, individually replanting trees, and removing individual big trees by helicopter. In the tropics of Southeast Asia and Pacific Islands, large-scale logging is carried out mainly by international logging companies, whose home offices are mainly in Malaysia and also in Taiwan and South Korea. They operate by leasing logging rights on land still owned by local people, exporting unfinished logs and not replanting. Much or most of the value of a log is added on by processing it after it has been felled. Hence, exporting unfinished logs deprives local people and the national government of most of the potential value of their resource. The companies frequently obtain the required government logging permit by bribing government officials and then proceed to cut logs beyond the boundaries of the area actually leased. Alternatively, the companies merely send in a logging ship, quickly negotiate permission with local people, carry out the logging, and dispense with a government permit. For example, about 70% of all wood cut in Indonesia comes from illegal operations that cost the Indonesian government nearly $1 billion a year in lost taxes, royalties, and lease payments. Local permission is obtained by wooing village leaders who may or may not have the power to sign away logging rights, and by taking those leaders to the national capital or overseas to Hong Kong, where they applied with luxury hotel accommodations, food, drink, and prostitutes until they sign. In addition, the company also obtains local acquiescence by making promises that will not be carried out, such as a promise to replant the forest and build hospitals. In some well-publicized cases in Indonesian Borneo, the Solomon Islands, and elsewhere, when loggers have arrived at a forest with a permit from the central government and started logging, local people who realize that this would be a bad deal for them attempted to stop the logging by blocking roads or burning sawmills, whereupon the logging company enlisted the police or army to enforce their rights. With such logging companies, we have to ask ourselves why they behave in a way that is morally reprehensible. The answer, again, is that their behavior is profitable to them. Rape-and-run logging of leased tropical forest land is immensely profitable, and will continue until the companies start to run out of unlogged countries, and until national governments and local landowners are prepared to refuse permission and to muster superior force in order to resist unpermitted logging, backed by force. In other countries, notably Western Europe and the United States, rape-and-run logging has become increasingly unprofitable. Large logging companies operate on land that they own or else hold by long-term lease rather than short-term lease, thereby giving them, under some circumstances, an economic incentive for sustainability. Many consumers are sufficiently aware environmentally to care whether the wood products that they are purchasing have been harvested in destructive, non-sustainable ways. Government regulation is sometimes serious and restrictive, and government officials are not readily bribed. Some logging companies have adopted sound practices and have attempted to convince the public of that, but they found that their claims on their own behalf lack credibility in the eyes of the public. For instance, many wood and paper products carry labels making claims such as, "For every tree felled, at least two are planted." However, a survey of 80 such claims found that 77 could not be substantiated at all, and almost all were withdrawn when challenged. Understandably, the public has learned to dismiss such claims made by companies themselves. Adding to the timber company's concern about their credibility was their concern about the impending extinction of forests, the basis of their business. More than half of the world's original forests have been cut down or heavily damaged in the last 8,000 years. More than half of those losses have occurred within the past 50 years. Only 12% of the world's forests lie within protected areas. In a worst-case scenario, all of the world's readily accessible remaining forests outside those protected areas would be harvested unsustainably within the next several decades. Although the world could meet its timber needs sustainably from a small area, 20% or less, of those forests if they were well managed. Those concerns about the long-term future of their own industry impelled some timber industry representatives and foresters in the early 1990s to launch discussions with environmental and social organizations and associations of indigenous peoples. In 1993, those discussions resulted in the formation of an international nonprofit organization called the Forest Stewardship Council, which is headquartered in Germany and funded by businesses, governments, foundations, and environmental organizations. The FSC's original tasks were threefold: to draw up a list of criteria of sound forest management, then to set up a mechanism for certifying whether any particular forest satisfied those criteria, and finally, to set up another mechanism for tracing product from a certified forest through the supplier chain all the way to the consumers, so that a consumer could know whether the paper, chair, or board that he or she was buying in a store and that carried the FSC logo actually came from a soundly managed forest. The first of those tasks resulted in the formulation of 10 detailed criteria of sound and sustainable forest management. The next task was to establish a process for ascertaining whether the management of a given forest meets those criteria. The FSC does not certify forest itself. Instead, it accredits forest certification organizations. An owner or manager of a forest contracts with a certification organization for an inspection and pays for the audit without any advance guarantee of a favorable outcome. The certifier's response after the inspection is often to impose a list of preconditions that must be met before approval, or to grant provisional approval based on a list of conditions that must be met before use of the FSC label will be permitted. It should be emphasized that the initiative in getting a forest certified must always be taken by the owner or manager, The certifiers do not go around inspecting forests uninvited. The remaining step was to document what is called the chain of custody, or paper trail, by which wood from a tree cut in Oregon ends up as a board offered for sale in a store in Miami. For the ultimate consumer to have confidence that the board she is buying really came from a tree in a certified forest, intermediate suppliers must keep certified and non-certified materials separate, and auditors must certify that every intermediate supplier is actually doing that. Only about 17% of the products from certified forests end up bearing the FSC's logo in a retail store. The other 83% get commingled with non-certified products along the chain. Certifying the chain of custody sounds like, and really is, a big pain in the neck, but it is essential. Do enough members of the public really care about environmental issues for FSC certification to help sell wood products? And would they be willing to pay a little more for an FSC-labeled product? These questions were put to the test in an experiment carried out at two Home Depot stores in Oregon. Each store set up two nearby bins containing plywood pieces of the same size. The plywood in one bin carried the FSC label, and the plywood in the other bin didn't. When the cost was the same, FSC-labeled plywood outsold unlabeled plywood by more than 2-to-1. When the labeled plywood cost 2% more than the unlabeled plywood, most customers preferred the cheaper product. But nevertheless, a large minority, 37%, still proceeded to buy the labeled product. Thus, much of the public really does weigh environmental values in its purchasing decisions, and a significant fraction of the public is willing to pay more for those values. The list of big businesses that participated in the initial formation of the FSC, joined on the board of directors, or committed themselves more recently to FSC goals includes some of the world's largest producers and sellers of timber products. Among U.S.-based companies are Home Depot, Lowe's, Kinko's, Collins Pine and Kane Hardwoods, Gibson Guitars, and Anderson Corporation. Major participants outside the U.S. include Tembec and Domtar, two of Canada's largest forest managers, Sainsbury's, the second-largest United Kingdom supermarket chain, and Swedish-based IKEA. These and other businesses all embrace the FSC because they saw it as advancing their economic interests, but they reached that conclusion through varying combinations of push and pull. The push is that some of these firms were targets of campaigns by environmental groups dissatisfied with company practices. For instance, Home Depot was pressured by the Rainforest Action Network. As for the pull factor, companies recognize many opportunities for maintaining or increasing their sales to an increasingly discerning public. In defense of Home Depot and other companies whose motivation included some pushing, they understandably had to move cautiously while making changes in the network of suppliers that they had built up over many years. Home Depot is now pressuring its suppliers in Chile and South Africa to adopt FSC standards. Another potent force behind the spread of FSC-labeled products in the U.S. is the Green Building Standard, known as LEED, Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design. This code rates the environmental design and use of materials in the construction industry. An increasing number of American state governments and cities give tax credits to companies adopting high LEED standards, and many American government buildings projects require companies involved in the project to follow LEED standards. The forest certification movement has spread rapidly around the world since the FSC's launching in 1993. To the point where at present there are certified forests and chains of custody in about 64 countries. The area of certified forests now totals 156,000 square miles, of which 33,000 are in North America. The countries in which the highest percentages of forest products sold are FSC labeled are the United Kingdom, where about 20% of all wood sold is FSC certified, and the Netherlands. The effectiveness of the Forest Stewardship Council has received the ultimate compliment from logging companies opposed to it. They have set up their own competing certification organizations with weaker standards. These include the Sustainable Forestry Initiative in the U.S., set up by the American Forest and Paper Association, the Canadian Standards Association, and the Pan-European Forest Council. The effect, and presumably the purpose, is to confuse the public. All of these knockoffs differ from the FSC in that they do not require independent third-party certification, but they permit companies to certify themselves. I'm not joking.